Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of transformation took place in Beijing leading up to the 2008 Summer Olympics? And did all those changes present an authentic picture of life in China's capital city? My guest today first arrived in Beijing in 2004 and remained to witness what $40 billion paid for by way of infrastructure upgrades, building demolition and construction, and cosmetic enhancements in time for the Games 3 summers ago. He also watched as Beijing residents brushed up on their English, refined their habits, and prepared to open their once closed-off metropolis to the visitors and cameras from every corner of the world. Tom Skoka is managing editor of Deadspin and a columnist for Slate. His new book is called Beijing Welcomes You, Unveiling the Capital City of the Future. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
So what sort of ideas did you have about China and what it might be like to live there before you actually went to live there?
I didn't really know much about what it would be like. I wasn't somebody who had spent a lot of time studying China or trying to be one of the China hands. So I knew people who had gone over, especially in the 90s, mm-hmm. and there were these stories of privation. They had to burn cabbage all winter for heat and eat coal, or the other way around, or something. You know, just a very like cold water backward, forbidding place.
Mm-hmm.
And so, obviously you're sort of aware that China is changing, but then on getting to the city, I realized that there was something very different going on.
And when you touched down for the first time, your overwhelming impression was about the air quality.
Yes. The air quality, the air could be smelled before the plane doors even opened. Mm-hmm. The pollution there is just far beyond anything that if you've just been in the U.S., you can imagine the worst, the worst hazy, miserable summer day here. The air is like what it's like on a good day in Beijing. The pollution often goes off the end of the scale for air quality. It's like being constantly surrounded by fog, only it's not fog. Or there are days that look like a gray, rainy day, but it's not raining.
You make an interesting point in the book, by the way, that we Americans might turn up our noses at the filthy air in Chinese cities, but we're consuming the factory products that contribute to the problem.
Right. It's essentially, going to China is a way of seeing sort of the backside of the life that we're living.
Hmm.
This is where all the goods that are being produced for us are being made. So these factories are implicated in our own lives. And the Chinese also have an attitude toward the pollution problem that the West had the chance to pollute its own air to get rich. And so we, fouled our water and fouled our air and poured poison into the system. And then we got rich enough to let other countries do that. And we, emerged to a cleaner lifestyle now. And so China argues that they should be given the same chance to pass through a stage of development and eventually arrive at a cleaner future. The problem, of course, is that it's going on in China on such a scale that there might not be any environment left to recover after the industrialization and prosperity have happened.
So the question you asked yourself at the beginning was whether this was an imminent utopia or a dystopia.
Right. It's a funny overlay of the two different things, because you're seeing this city, which is immense and frantically rebuilding itself, trying to make the most futuristic infrastructure it can. There are these showpiece buildings being built. The transit system is being improved. And it's all sort of extremely future-focused and, kind of a thrilling little window into a place that wants to participate in the 21st century. But at the same time, there are all the side effects of this, the rampant pollution, the sort of wanton destruction of historical places. And there are also the considerable political problems. And part of the question that I was interested in doing this book, is whether this assumption that the progress and prosperity bring liberalization is really true, or whether the Chinese state is going to be able to maintain its authoritarian character even as the physical equipment of daily life becomes more and more modern and even futuristic.
Let's talk a little bit about culture. One of the interesting things you discovered was that Chinese people were more than happy to make sweeping generalizations about themselves, but they often contradicted the sweeping generalization you'd heard half an hour earlier on the same subject.
Yes. There's a definite habit, if I may generalize, of people wanting to chalk everything from individual behavior to policies and, you know, major news events to some essential Chinese-ness, you know, that things happened in China because Chinese people have a certain way of looking at the world. But what soon emerged was that these could be wildly contradictory, you know, that be told that Chinese people are extremely practical about money, and then, you know, the Chinese people are inclined to spend money lavishly to make a show, that they're very reserved and cautious and over polite, and that they are unreserved and willing to speak their mind in a way that Westerners aren't, and, you know, and on and on. And of course, the underlying message is that the reason that the Chinese people are all this way is that they are not as exceptional as a class of people as they think, and that like most people, they have different outlooks about different things at different times.
Well, it's 1.3 billion people. It's hard, I guess, to make a sweeping generalization about
exactly.
Many things. Yeah. One thing, my husband lived in China for a short time in the 90s and noticed that people do not line up there. And so I was really interested to read the sections of your book which talk about this issue of sort of crowding in when you're waiting for something. And the Chinese government recognized that Westerners in particular would find this objectionable and tried to sort of fix the way the city waited for things in leading up to the Olympics.
They did. They had the problem with lining up for things is, I think, a real generalization you can make about Chinese society, and that the government was very much invested in this. There were other kinds of behavior were also subject to these reform campaigns. There's a big effort to get people to stop spitting in the street, which they do all the time. That was modestly successful. For the lining up, they designated the 11th of each month as lining up day because the two ones of 11 in the logo for these events represented that even if there were just two people, one should stand politely in line behind the other.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent out marshals to bus stops to try to get people to line up in an orderly manner, and that got nowhere. It just the crowding around where other people would line up was ineradicable. I mean, it's funny. They another part of the campaign was to get people to stand on the right and walk on the left on escalators, mm-hmm. which nobody had done before. And in that case, actually, they painted a line down the middle of the escalator, put signs at the bottom telling people to pass on the left or stand on the right, and that worked, which was sort of shocking once you'd been used to the constant milling and jostling of crowds in Chinese public spaces to see that in that particular case, they were willing to change their habits.
That's got to be disconcerting as an American, where we don't think of lining up as something that's anything other than logical. We don't recognize that it in fact is cultural in this country in the same way that not lining up is cultural in China.
Right. It's more like maybe the American analogy would be the way that people behave in traffic when there's a lane closure,
mm-hmm.
where I think there are other countries where people have a very well-established orderly culture of taking turns, but in the U.S. you always have people trying to jump the line and stay in the in the lane that's going to be closed until the last minute.
Right. So what did Beijing have to get done between the time you arrived in 2004 and the start of the Summer Games of 2008?
Gracious. They had to... Well, the thing about Beijing's Olympic development was that unlike... or the development that was associated with the Olympics, is that unlike in other cities that host the Olympics, where the big project is to, you know, build a bunch of otherwise useless giant stadiums, plant some flowers, do some beautification, and, you know, build this particular Olympic infrastructure that you then claim is going to be useful to the city in years to come, Beijing used the Olympics as an occasion to focus the redevelopment that the city was going to be undergoing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So while there certainly were these showpiece Olympic projects and the construction of the Olympic Green and the construction of the Olympic Forest and those sort of large-scale Olympic-specific public works, they also drastically expanded the subway system. I think that by the time the Games came, it had tripled or quadrupled in length and has kept on expanding since then. When I got there, there were only two subway lines, one loop and one east-west crosstown line, and you basically couldn't take the subway anywhere. And by now, you can really get around Beijing on the subway. They built a gigantic new airport terminal. They built what's called the Central Business District, which isn't actually in the center of the city. It's off to the side on the east, but it's a high-rise downtown, you know, with star architects, office buildings, and various other things, you know, where there was just nothing before.
Was the construction all up to sort of developed world standards as far as you could tell? I know you're not an architect.
That's an open question. So far, it's held up. There was a strange episode with this CCTV building that Rem Koolhaas designed, Loop, that was sort of a big...
Yeah.
Focus of the run-up to the Games, where its sister building, the TVCC building, caught on fire shortly before it was supposed to open in 2009 in a fireworks accident. And this very, very modern glass and steel building, for some reason, just went up in flames. And so as a result of that, the famous Loop building, I think that it might be finally on its way to opening, but that was originally something that was supposed to be ready for the Olympics, and instead, 2 years later, it was sitting there still empty with this companion building being just a burned-out hulk beside it.
Now, all over town, the residential lanes that had existed for decades were marked for demolition. Can you
centuries.
Talk a little bit about that? Centuries.
Yes. The architecture of the old Beijing was built around courtyard houses, whose outer walls formed these alleys called hutongs, which were these gray, single-story, fairly featureless mazes of walls. You know, the lanes sort of jogging around at roughly right angles, but not in a particularly orderly way, and that's sort of what's classically identified with old Beijing. And huge swaths of this stuff got demolished in the push for modernization. And some of it, again, there's the problem of gentrification in general, where they really were clearing substandard housing. But this was substandard housing in buildings that were centuries old.
Let me jump in here for a minute. We need to take a quick break, and I want you to be able to finish this thought. My guest is Tom Skoka, managing editor of Deadspin and a columnist for Slate. His new book is called Beijing Welcomes You, Unveiling the Capital City of the Future. We'll resume our conversation with Tom in a couple of minutes, and you're invited to join us now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Tom Skoka about his new book, Beijing Welcomes You, Unveiling the Capital City of the Future. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Tom, before the break, we were talking about the displacement of tens of thousands of people from these traditional lanes, these hutongs, which inarguably were dilapidated in many cases, but which also had been home as long as many families could remember.
Yes, and the question, you know, is what you do with that kind of housing stock, and what you do with the people who live there, and they tended to. Relocate people to, you know, apartment complexes further out of town, and in the cases where these hutong neighborhoods have not been demolished, because eventually the idea that this architecture was worth saving got through mm-hmm. on some levels, they've, you know, many of them have returned to their original function of being mansions for the people near the emperor's court, or in this case, for the, you know, the new wealthy class of Beijing. So you have these houses that are lavishly restored and have a garage door added to the outside for that person's Audi, and you know, but the people who were living there before are somewhere else.
Where did they go?
Just further from the center of town. Beijing has these ring roads, you know, extending concentrically away from the city center. So the second ring is where, there isn't a first ring for some reason, but the second ring is where the old city wall originally was. And then you have the third ring and the fourth ring, and then the fourth and fifth rings are where you get these new apartment developments. Where people have relocated to.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email that you can send to think@kera.org. Let's talk about this. People who have never been to Beijing have still seen the amazing photographs from years ago of huge throngs of people getting around the city by bicycle. A few years ago, though, cycling seems to have fallen conspicuously out of favor as a mode of transportation. How did that affect day-to-day living in Beijing?
Well, one of the sort of questions about the rise of Beijing and of the new Chinese prosperity is, it really gives us a lesson in the question of how scalable what we think of as our way of life is when you extend it to more and more people around the world. And in the case of Beijing, the car has taken over at an incredible pace. So when I got there in 2004, there were probably 2 million cars on the road. And by 2008, there were 3 million. And they passed 4 million, I think, earlier this year. And the result of that has been that the traffic has just ground to a halt. When I first got there, people talked about how bad the traffic was. And, you know, I've lived in metropolitan Washington, D.C. I've driven through the Lincoln Tunnel in New York here. I'm used to really bad traffic, and you know, these people didn't know what they were talking about. But by the time 2008 rolled around, and certainly by 2009, the traffic was as bad as anywhere in the world. I mean, just unbelievable traffic jams. You essentially couldn't get anywhere on time in Beijing. You'd have to either gamble and show up 40 minutes early because you would leave so early in the morning that you would miss the rush, or you would get stuck and get there an hour late.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Patty on the line in Dallas. Hi, Patty.
Hello. So interesting. I, too, was in Beijing in 2004. I was on my way down to a little photo workshop in Tibet, but I stayed in one of the hutong hotels, and I was just wondering, is it a specific area of the hutongs that have been demolished? It just kills me, the thought that area could be demolished. But is it, I mean, it seems, I don't know, it seems like the hotel I was staying was maybe something like the Lusong or something like that, but it was in the hutong area. But it was so amazing. I just wondered if certain parts of that Hutong area have been demolished and others are still there?
Some parts have been preserved. Which ones? It's hard to guess from where your original Hutong Hotel might have been, whether that patch has survived or not. Even the ones that seem to have survived can have a later setback. There's a around the bell and drum towers, which is some of the oldest stuff, and really, you know, classic old Beijing. Those all survived the Olympics fine, but then there was a plan to replace them with a more up to date. I guess it's like what we call Disneyfication here. You know, this idea to build a better than old Beijing replica of the old Beijing, and they're going to orient it. They're going to have some kind of museum of expensive watches that it was all going to be built around. And I don't know whether that's going forward now or not. There was a lot of back and forth about it, but you're never sure that the historical preservation that's happened is going to keep happening.
I know, Tom, that there was a nominal appeals process for people who were informed that their homes were going to be razed. But I'm curious about how this whole story was covered in the Chinese media and sort of what the official line was of the government and how open people were to express, when it existed, their dissatisfaction.
Well, it's definitely what's known as a sensitive subject. There is some coverage of relocation issues in the Chinese press. You get these spectacles of what are called nail houses, where one person has refused to sell or has refused to move out and just keeps occupying their house in the middle of construction, you know, so that you have, in the middle of a giant construction pit, you have this single house surviving. Those sometimes become the focus of national news attention. And people do take their complaints public, but it's one of those issues that there's a limit to how much coverage it gets, and there's a limit to how much complaining people are allowed to make. And a big case of that was in one of the worst episodes surrounding the Olympics themselves. They had announced that there would be official protest zones for people to, you know, to have protests during the Olympics, and the people who were upset about having been displaced or being threatened with displacement signed up to protest and then were arrested for disturbing the peace by applying to protest at the designated protest areas.
So it was like they walked into a place where they could be collected and rounded up and sent to jail.
Yeah, you signed up to be. I think they actually got house arrest. But yes, they. That was one of the real low points of the Olympics.
So you are a journalist, but initially you didn't apply for a journalist visa. You were just sort of there working from a distance. Talk about the process by which you received your official credentials.
Oh, goodness. I don't think we have enough time.
It's NPR. We got a little time.
We need 3 hours to talk about the credentialing process. It was really an education for me. I had started going back and forth to China. In the beginning, I had a job in New York, and my wife had a job in Beijing, and I was going back and forth and taking extended visits. But so when it came time for me to move there full-time, and I wanted to write a book about it by then, you know, I knew that I wanted to turn the notes I'd been taking already into something like a book. I decided that the prudent thing to do would be to declare myself and register as a journalist. And this led to all sorts of bureaucratic hurdles. It had officially been made easier for journalists to report on China than it had been before. Before 2007, you had to get permission to travel anywhere. You needed an invitation from the people where you were going, and there were all these obstacles that were, with great ceremony, lifted. But just getting the visa to get into the country in the first place remained a huge hurdle. I got mine through the Olympic Organizing Committee, but they didn't have the power to give me more than 90 days. And so even though I was living there full-time, I never had more than 3 months before I had to reapply for permission to keep reporting. There's also just confusion because the system wasn't really set up for somebody who's writing a book. You know, they expect people to be foreign correspondents for newspapers and to have a bureau and to be registered through that system. And because I didn't fit into that system, I didn't really... I had to spend a lot of time finding out who I was even supposed to be applying to.
And then there was
apply for my journalist visa.
There was an issue that you'd written your first application with a ballpoint pen.
Yes, when I was the instructions said to fill the form out in black ink, and so fill the form out with a black ink pen. And I pulled out the ballpoint that I always carried with me, and I filled out the form and turned it in. And the man behind the counter said, "This is not a black ink pen," and it was black ink. Pulled out the pen, showed him the pen itself was black. And eventually it emerged that only a rollerball will do for official documents.
So you had to go down the street and buy a rollerball pen and write the whole thing out again. There's another interesting parallel here in your experience. You write very candidly that you arrived in the country with like an infant or maybe toddler level of language skills. And over your time there, through very dedicated study, you learned a great deal more working Mandarin. How did that affect your experience as things started to sort of come into focus and you could catch snippets of conversation around you in terms of understanding the city and the culture and the people among whom you were living?
It really helped, to get that. It is a very shocking experience if you don't have a real education in Chinese, because it's not like Europe where you can fake your way around a lot with English and where most of the alphabets are familiar.
Mm-hmm.
You can't read a lot of signs. You can't do even basic exchanges with people. And so it was sort of like having a radio with a very attenuated signal that over time tuned in, and then then you could start understanding what people were saying to each other as they handled your latest visa application. The cab drivers would start chatting you up, and it really did sort of make the whole thing more comprehensible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Lisa calling from Denton. Hi, Lisa.
Yes, hello. I'm calling from Denton, Texas with a question for your guest. We just came back from Beijing 2 weeks ago and had a driver drive us around, and I was intrigued by the lack of police really enforcing any rules on the road or any rules that I could see in Beijing. I was wondering if your guests could just address that issue of how they control all those people with their police force.
Thanks for your call.
The traffic is quite unregulated. It's sort of a strange situation because you have these millions of cars on the road, and most of the drivers have as much driving experience as a teenager. And there are all these sort of folk beliefs about how you should drive that don't really correspond to the way that you're used to driving in the U.S. My wife was driving around with her relatives in the countryside, the branch of the family that never left China, and they were losing their minds because she kept looking over her shoulder when changing lanes. And it was an absolute rule of driving that you never took your eyes off the road in front of you. I guess because no one else was taking their eyes off the road in front of them either, and so you just had to be responsible for whatever might confront you. But the traffic is not especially heavily regulated. I mean, there are rules about which cars are allowed in the city. The worst and most polluting ones are gradually phased out. But the as far as the behavior on the road goes, it's the sort of bicycle culture of everybody kind of schooling along and moving where they personally need to go has survived with cars, where it's much less appealing or safe.
How daunting was the specter of official government oversight for you as a now registered journalist and your wife working for an international nonprofit?
It was, the thing about that kind of authority and supervision is that it was usually invisible, and you never really knew whether anyone was paying attention to what you were doing or not, which was partly how the system is meant to operate. You don't know exactly where the lines are, and you don't know exactly what will get you in trouble. And part of the problem in the post-Olympic period has been that the lines have kept moving, and things have actually tightened up in a way that people who used to be able to get away with stuff can't get away with that. And so, as a journalist, you always sort of wondered if someone was going to get so mad that you wouldn't get your next visa. You know, you thought about if someone were reading your stuff, what they would think about it and how they would interpret it.
My guest is Tom Skoka. He's managing editor of Deadspin and a columnist for Slate. His new book is called Beijing Welcomes You, Unveiling the Capital City of the Future. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tom Skoka. His new book is called Beijing Welcomes You, Unveiling the Capital City of the Future. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Tom, I love the chapter about the thinking that went into China's selection of its five mascots for the Beijing Games. Can you talk about the Chinese impressions of what Westerners would and would not relate to?
Wow. The mascots are sort of beautiful embodiment of Chinese bureaucracy. There were all kinds of debates, it turned out, before they produced their five mascots, Bebe the fish, Jingjing the panda, Huanhuan the Olympic flame, Yingying the Tibetan antelope, and Nini the swallow, whose names taken together spell out Beijing Huanyingni, or Beijing welcomes you. So I had the mascots on my mind a lot as I worked on the book. They had all sorts of shibboleths and ideas about what would and wouldn't work. The dragon is a very important Chinese mythic animal and seemed to be a strong candidate for being part of this five mascot bureaucracy. But there was one strain of thought that the dragon was actually too dignified and sacred an animal to be included among the cartoon mascots. But there was also this belief that Westerners would regard dragons as evil and fear them and not find them an appealing mascot. So the dragon was shelved. They considered a crane, but they were afraid that the long beak on the crane would be too dangerous. I'm trying to remember what other...
I know the antelope got a sex change.
The antelope got a sex change because it turned out it was supposed to be female, but they had horns on it, and they decided to just change it to a boy so they could keep the horns. The antelope was kind of my favorite because it was this weird ethnic mashup of signifiers from China's west. They rather shamelessly, in the sort of descriptions of why they'd chosen each animal, the official description said that Yingying, the antelope, symbolized the vastness of China's territory. As the Tibetan antelope symbolized the vastness of China's territory, which it certainly does.
Yeah.
But they also took some sort of Islamic detailing from Xinjiang, where the Uyghur minority lives, and incorporated that into the headdress. They gave it curly hair because the people out west don't have as straight hair as the people in the east, and just sort of constructed this very strange representation of China's relationship with its western minorities and territories.
Did you sense that aspect of the, I don't know if you want to call it propaganda, but of the marketing for this was as much about convincing the Chinese people that everything was a certain way as it was about convincing the rest of the world?
China's official attitude toward its minority populations is sort of, does have this component of wishfulness, I think. Where ethnicity is taken to be a set of habits and costumes and a sort of discrete little culture that people happily indulge in while being at the same time happily incorporated into the People's Republic of China. There's a kind of awkward revelation after the Olympic opening ceremony where among the many revelations about the staging that went on, that the little children in minority costume dress who had been running around as part of the show were actually just Han Chinese children dressed up in minority costumes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Tim in Southlake. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Tom, it's great to hear from you. I have been to China since 81 and actually have attended 8 Summer Olympics. One of the things I noticed in Beijing, and wondered if you felt it, I felt like I went to a wedding with no reception. Everything looked perfect, but when you got behind the scenes, there was just no fun in the Olympics. It's probably the least interesting one I've been to out of 8.
That's a really good analogy. It also reminded me of New Year's. You know how when you get to the stroke of midnight, then all of a sudden you realize there's nothing really left to do?
The party's over.
Yeah. I think that it's interesting to hear that from somebody who attended the games and was at a lot of games. Because what happened was, in the end, Beijing put the principal focus on putting on the show, on keeping everything orderly, everything under control, everything staged just right. And so the reviews of it as a television program, I think, were universally positive. But when you're actually on the ground in the city felt that really got it. It was like a wedding with no reception. There was no sort of space for people to get out and enjoy it. There wasn't a sense that this happy civic occasion was going on. When the games were, when Beijing was awarded the games, a million people spilled out into the streets. There was this great sort of legendary celebration that went with it. But the games themselves were not really that much fun. There was sort of too much anxiety, too much control, too much police presence, too many restrictions on day-to-day behavior, and so it felt like that. There was this the moment itself was not as fun as the anticipation of the moment by any means.
During the time that you were living in Beijing, you and your wife were expecting your first child. You had originally intended for her to give birth in the U.S., and then for health reasons it didn't work out that way. Can you talk a little bit about your experience of giving birth to a child in a Chinese hospital?
That was a real turning point, I think, in the whole experience. Because, yeah, we had planned to get out of Beijing, spend a summer in New York. The baby was due in August, and we'd come back in the fall and settle down and watch the rest of the Olympic preparations. And instead, 2 weeks before we were supposed to fly back in early June, the baby arrived. And, when that happens, there's nothing you can do but be where you are. So there was an expat hospital where we'd been doing prenatal stuff anyway. So we were used to the hospital. It's very modern, very, very nice, well-appointed, great ultrasound machines, and everything. But the principal setback as this was going on, and as we were realizing that we were going to be having the kid there, is that the Chinese hospital requires payment up front. And so actually, literally as they were prepping my wife for the cesarean after 33 hours of labor, someone beckoned me out in the hallway, and it turned out to be somebody from the billing department who was anxious to secure the payment before they would proceed with the delivery.
No cash, no cut.
Yeah, well, they would take credit cards, and I found myself standing in the hallway trying to calculate how many days of the hospitalization we could get within our credit limit.
Yeah.
Luckily, my wife's employer, someone from them had come by, and they managed to convince the billing department that the medical care would be paid for. But it was not really what you plan to go through when your child is being born. But the medical care itself was it seemed fine. I mean, he came through it in great shape. He had to spend a few weeks in the hospital, but with no complications. And, in the end, he was. We had a native of Beijing living with us, which we had not expected.
And his middle name reflects that, is that right?
Yes. There's a... Traditionally, my wife's Chinese-American, and there's a whole traditional Chinese system for how you give people their generational Chinese names. And so we turned that responsibility over to her father. But rather than having anything to do with that system, he just decided that we should name the boy Zhongsheng, meaning born in China.
Hmm.
And so we did.
You also came across some interesting cultural differences in terms of, how a baby should be raised, including I had to chuckle that you're struggling, as all first-time parents do, to get the car seat properly installed in the cab that took you all home from the hospital. And the hospital staff is looking at you like, why doesn't this idiot just hold the baby?
Yes. Yeah, the child safety seat was the most incomprehensible foreign affectation. really only you need seat belts to put a car seat in a car. So I would lug the car seat down, down the alley to the intersection where the taxis would be found. And really about one in five would have a seat belt that could be deployed in the back seat to hold it. I mean, that was some applied Chinese, because you have to just ask every cabbie if they have seat belts in the back or not. And then eventually, once he moved from the infant seat to where in the U.S. you'd have him in a sort of normal toddler car seat, we just gave up. He rattled around loose in the cabs, and we hoped for the best.
Based on the photo in the jacket of the book, you're blonde-haired, your features are very European, but toward the end when you spoke better Mandarin, I mean, did you gained enough of an understanding of the way the city moves and lives that you yourself felt toward the end like less than a foreigner? Less of a foreigner, I should say.
I don't know if I ever felt like less of a foreigner, but I did feel at home with the city.
Mm-hmm.
You become familiar with the way that things work and the way that people are, and you develop affection for it, even at its worst. There's a certain quality of the light on a day that's only mildly polluted. There's this sort of pearly glow that you don't get from clean air ever. And even that sort of was charming, but not as charming as fresh, clean air.
You conclude at the end of the book that there are three Beijings, the one that is moneyed and artificial, one that is wretched and broken, and one that is alive and bustling. Do you suspect that has always been and will always be the case for that city in particular?
I think there probably are, that all those strains have been represented in the past. I mean, in China, historically, there's always been this tremendous divide between the very poor masses and the people who are prospering in the cities, and between sort of grand ambitions, be they imperial or communistic or whatever we call our consumers, 21st century culture, between these grand ambitions and the sort of day-to-day life of people. And so you have these different strains all jostling against each other. And, you could convince yourself you're seeing the real China when you see one part of it, but it really is the interplay of all these things. And one of the great lessons of the whole thing is that China is really anything but monolithic, and it's a single party state. There's tight control, but it's not the sort of centralized command system that we might think it is here in the U.S. But there's all these different incentives and attitudes and values are competing with each other. That the central government and the provincial government and the local government are frequently at odds. That environmental reformers and industrialists are at odds, and the tensions within China, are going to sort themselves out in ways that we can't even predict.
Tom Skoka's new book is called Beijing Welcomes You, Unveiling the Capital City of the Future. Tom, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.